I consider it very fortunate for us that we have a chairman of the board with us at this conference. He is a man who now he claims to be an honorary alcoholic. But I doubt very much if he can qualify for even that. With the qualities he has, because he has all these qualities that I've mentioned and many more. He's been with us on board for about 14 years. He's been chairman of our board for the past 5 years. And I don't know of any AA in my some 20 years of experience who is any more dedicated than the man you are to hear and whom I consider it a very great privilege to introduce to you, to those of you who don't know him, our beloved Dr. Jack.
Thank you, Roy. And thanks a lot, friends, for inviting me down. It's a real privilege and a pleasure to me to be here and down and see the wonderful people that you have sent up to New York as delegates and having sent Roy as trustee. We're sorry that we have him for only 2 years instead of the four, which the trustees, I hate the AB business, but the AA trustees ordinarily have before they are forced to move on. It's good to see you. It's good to see the people here, my friends, who have come up as delegates. We missed one, Bob, missed him a lot, as he was one of the best. I hope someday you'll send a woman up as delegate. From what I have seen of the quality of your AA here, with the relationships that you have demonstrated in this conference with Al-Anon and the strength of Al-Anon in the area, I see a few other teams around. Even this morning, I think I saw an Al-Tart. I suspect there may be a few Al-Awets back home. Jed was a New England farmer. New Hampshire farmer. No, New Hampshire is a state where you have to sharpen your sheep's nose in order to have them grow up and develop any wool. But Jed was prosperous enough way back when telephones were first invented, so that he was one of the first men in town to have a telephone. It was new, and one of his friends had come around to see the thing. It was one of the old wind-up times, you know. And they were sitting on the front porch and chatting away, and the telephone rang. Jed didn't move. This is a true story. About the grandfather of an Episcopal priest friend of mine who was a member of AA. Telephone rang again, and Jed still didn't move. Rang again, still didn't move. Aren't you going to answer it? No, I put that in for my convenience, not somebody else's. Well, that's the way we do it in New Hampshire. One of the things that AA's asked me most often is how I got this way. Of course, I'm a physician, and during my first few years in practice, I was no use whatever to an alcoholic. I could get them over the acute phases of it. I could get them past some of the major medical difficulties that were going on with it. Two of the first cases that I tried to help were paralyzed, partially paralyzed, because of the nutritional deficiencies on their nervous system. We got them past that, but they went on, both of them, and died an alcoholic death. And then when I first went to work at Kodak Park in Rochester, occasionally people were sent to me by supervision. Can't you do something for Simon or Joe or Jake? Well, some of our best people, but they always show up missing at the wrong time. And I was never any use to any of them. So I hated to see him coming, because what was I accomplishing? I wasn't telling them anything that they hadn't told themselves. They knew that they were hurting themselves physically. They knew they couldn't stand it too much longer. But we had little or nothing to offer. And finally, one day, a chap that I'd been working with, holding up his sick benefit, his wife would call me every once in a while on the telephone, complain to me, wasn't getting anywhere, and finally Bill came in the office. He said, haven't seen you quite a while, have you, doctor? I said, no, Bill, what did? And he dropped a pamphlet on my desk about AA and said, here's how. A little while later, one of the young supervisors, a fellow that had come into the color process way back in the early days of color photography, who had come into the company as a high school graduate, had grown with the process, and at the time that I was seeing him, he had three or four college graduates and a PhD working for him. His complaints were butterflies. I thought he had a stomach ulcer, but we could never prove it by x-ray or any other way. But I still thought, well, here's a young man with a high school education who's responsible for the work of people who've had far more educational opportunities than he. Of course he's nervous. So we tried to help, but it wasn't doing much good. One day after he'd been out of work about 3 months, and we were paying him full salary as sick benefit. Well, this nurse called me and said, you remember Bert? I said, yes. He said, did you know he had a problem with alcohol? And I said, good night, no. Well, he has. His wife's taking their two little boys and gone back to her mother. He's telling people that he can tell Dr. Norris anything and Dr. Norris will believe him. That's literally true. He said he is working with one of the AA members at one of the other plants in the city. I think you'll be hearing from him in a little while. Telephone rang. I introduced himself as Bob. He said, I'm an AA member over at Hawkeye. Hawkeye works for the company. But I've been working with Bert the last 2 or 3 days. He's pretty sick. He's taking it out. I think he'll be back into work on Monday. Whether this is it or not, I don't know. I suspect he may have to fall flat on his face once more before he really, really makes it. Bert came in the following Monday, and he brought the superintendent of his department and his immediate supervisor with him. He'd got enough AA to tell them what his problem was. And they told me and Bert at that time that he still had his job, but if it happened again, he was through. A little over a month later, it did happen again. And so far as he knew, he was through. But as we talked with him before he left that day, he suggested that he get a job somewhere else, keep at AA and work at it, and keep in touch with it. This was in March or April, as I recall. He went to work for a baby food plant in Rochester, loading boxcars. This was something of an assignment. The fellow had been the supervisor of a group of about 100 people. But Bert did work at AA. He did keep in touch with us. And in September, he went back to work. Bert invited me to AA meetings, and I went to several with him. He invited me to one where our Bill was talking. And in this way, I learned to appreciate AA, learned how to work with it. And after that, whenever anyone would come into the office in trouble, I would call Bert. He'd leave whatever he was doing, come over to the office. And I knew that under these circumstances, the introduction to AA was a good introduction. And together we worked out a technique that worked. And we were able to help a good many people in the plant to find their way into AA. A couple of years after that, a young man was brought to me by his supervisor in another section of the company. The supervisor told me that this fellow had lost the Navy commission during the war, having lost the commission, he behaved himself until the end of the war, had an honorable discharge, and under the GI Bill was admitted to medical school. At that time, there were 18, I think that's the figure, applications to medical school for every opening there was. And this boy was admitted. This gives you some idea of what he had between his ears. During that first year in medical school, he studied during the week, drank pretty heavily on weekends, and toward the end of the school year, decided that his work was interfering with his pleasure and that it wasn't worth staying on another year. He could have stayed on, he had the grades, but it just wasn't worth it to him. During the next couple of years, he had three different jobs as detail man for pharmaceutical houses. Quit each one of them before he was fired. Then the jobs that he could get were less and less attractive to him. Finally, before he was given a job with us at Kodak Park, he'd been a bartender for 6 or 8 months. He showed a good deal of promise. To get the picture, this guy was a brilliant boy. My supervision for the first few weeks that he was on the job felt that he had great promise. And then he developed an absenteeism pattern. And after he'd been around 6 or 8 months, the supervisor talked with him, told him that they had great hopes for him, but that with the developing pattern of absenteeism, unless this straightened out, they wouldn't be able to keep him. 2 weeks later, he came on the job drunk. He first was sent home. Supervisor talked with him the next morning and offered him the help of the medical department. He accepted. He was brought over to me. And taking his history and doing a physical examination, I'd made up my mind that he was an alcoholic. And told him that in my judgment, his only safety from then on was total abstinence. I told him that there were very few people in my experience that were able to do it alone. That I'd like to have him meet a friend of mine who had had the same problem, but who had been able to stay happily sober for a period of years. Did you mean AA? I said, yes. But no thanks. I'll do it my own way. Supervisor kept in touch with me. He was quite enthusiastic about the change in him. At the end of a month, I called him back. First thing he came, he said to me as he came through the office door was, "Doctor, you know, it's been only within the last 3 days that I could think the way I used to do." He was 29 at the time. Hadn't had very many years of really serious drinking. He hadn't hit a really low bottom. But it took this young man a month to clear the fog away. And that's what he taught me, that it takes a while to get the thinking back to reasonable clarity again. One of my good friends in Rochester was a physician, one of the first group of AA in Rochester. And incidentally, AA was brought to Rochester by a psychiatrist who visited his patients. In fact, used to say that everybody has three bottoms: economic, social, and psychological. Some people have to hit all three. It is harder to reach people that still have a job, to reach people who have or think they have considerable social status, whatever that may mean. Some people do have to lose everything before they can take the first step in AA, before they can really surrender. But we are learning to bring the bottom up so that people can be brought to reach the psychological bottom. Everybody has to surrender. Everybody has to admit that their life has become unmanageable. Some lives aren't quite as unmanageable as some others. So we are learning to raise the bottom. It's been my observation over the years that it is harder to work for people in with people in a department who have the problem. If the superintendent of the group is beginning to worry about his own drinking. We had known for several years that the superintendent of one of our largest departments was in trouble with alcohol. We hadn't been able to do anything much with the people in his group. It was a little over a year and a half ago, that the problem with this superintendent got to the point where his boss told him he had to do something about it. He'd been treating with his private physician. And the physician had been doing the thing that most of us do as physicians, and giving him medication of one sort and another to help him get over his nervousness. I've been telling him to cut down on his drinking. I don't know how well that worked. Finally, we had the authority of company management to hospitalize him. And he was hospitalized in an institution outside of New York for 6 months. Now, this is something of a shock for a man who'd been in charge of a unit in the company with some 3,000 employees in it, with an annual budget of several millions of dollars. But Jack went to the Westchester Division of the New York Hospital. There, they have respect for AA. They don't understand it quite as well as they wish they did, but they're learning. Now, Jack is not a wholehearted, enthusiastic member of AA at this point. On the other hand, there's nobody that I would rather have do a 12-step job than this man. He's a grand person. And on the basis of the quality of the 12-step jobs that he has done for me, I was able the other day to recommend to management that he be given a substantial promotion. Whether they will or not, I don't know, but at least I could tell them that in my judgment, we don't need to worry about alcoholism in this man anymore. I hope I'm right. I think I am. And he's a grand person. We have an ex-Baptist minister that's at the West Chester Division of the New York Hospital right now. I had a letter from his wife 5 or 6 years ago telling me about Max, telling me that in her judgment he was an alcoholic, can't you do something, but don't tell him I told you. Well, I took the opportunity to get acquainted with Mac, talk with him about alcohol, tell him what the problem is like. He started playing cat and mouse with me then, and he did it in and out of AA for several years, up until about 4 months ago. One of his contacts in AA, one of the people that had tried to work with him, was a physician colleague of mine who was himself a member of AA. I couldn't have picked any stronger people, and I wouldn't know them. Unless possibly some of you or Roy down here, I think, could do a job on him. But he still played cat and mouse. He'd go down to the AA group at neighboring state prison. He worked with another chap that I'll tell you about next. I'm trying to get a really active, vital AA group going in our local county penitentiary. He'd come back and say how wonderful it was, and then every once in a while be drunk on the job. So the thing we did with him was to pull the rug out from under him so far as his job was concerned. Because you have two choices. You'll either go down to the hospital and begin to take this thing seriously and take AA seriously, or you're not likely to have a job. Something of a shock to him. He was a football player in college. He got the idea of telling other people what to do. As a minister, he was a personage. He built a shell around himself. Ministers, physicians, lawyers, people in public life are accustomed to having people tell them how good they are, how wonderful they are, and it's awfully hard not to begin to believe it. And Mac did believe it. Made me think a little bit about the story of the mule, you know, that was owned by a Quaker, and the Quaker sold him to a friend and said, "You've always got to be you got to be careful with this mule. Treat him kindly and talk to him, persuade him to do what you want him to do." A little bit later, one of his friends came by the farm and saw him break a tube before over the mule's head. He said, "I thought you had to be kind to this mule and persuade him to do things right. I know, but you have to get his attention." Well, we had to break the tube before over, Max said, in order to get his attention. As we are learning that people have to want AA, but they can be helped to want. And if we are in a position of authority, we can use the authority that we have intelligently, rather than to let people go on and on and on and on year after year in their struggles, lose everything, If you don't think this is force, it's an impersonal force, it's a cruel force, instead of an intelligent, sympathetic understanding, use of authority or force in order to promote the acceptance of the idea that I'm in trouble with alcohol. Ray'd been in serious trouble with the law. He was waiting sentence to state prison. He was a two-time loser, and in New York State, anyone who commits a felony twice goes to state prison. Ray had three children. He was a very able guy. And while he was out waiting for his final sentencing, he came in to see me and said, "Doctor, I'll do anything. I don't know whether you can help me or not. I'm quite sure I don't have a job." He worked with us 13 years. "I have made arrangements for the care of my family while I'm away from them, but I will do anything." As I talked with him, examined him, I was convinced that there was nothing to be gained by anybody, including society, Ray going to prison. I was also convinced that he was sincere in his desire to do something. He had a brother, also an employee of the company, who had been in trouble with alcohol, who had found his way sort of half-heartedly into AA. But I referred Ray to our clinic and a psychiatrist. Made contact for him with the physician colleague whom I spoke about a few moments ago, also a member of AA. Between us, we went to bat for him with the judge and got him on probation. We talked to the probation officer. I twisted a couple of arms on the job so that we kept his job for him. And Ray is right now one of the strongest people in our penitentiary AA group. And I get a real thrill every time I talk with Ray and think of what's happened to him, to his family, and the way he's fitting into the general picture in the community to try and do the sort of thing that Judge Ray was talking about last night. This is how I get this way. We don't succeed with all of them. John's one of the most charming people I know. Brought up as a salesman. And he could tell you anything. Wonderful family, three children, father and mother were missionaries in Korea. He was born in Korea. But his sense of guilt associated with the things that he has done in his drinking is so great that he can't live with it. We've done our best to tell him AA. And he just isn't reached by it. You can't get hold of it. He's today in the state hospital, just gone through a period of electroshock therapy to get him past the worst depression I've ever seen in anybody. So deep that he won't talk, can't talk. I doubt that Don's going to make it. I don't know. And he has illness, serious illness. But even with the best judgment, the best hope that all of us working together can bring to bear on him, we're failing. another handler in one of our departments where there's a fair amount of work to do, has been for many years a daily drinker, fairly heavy drinker. He's one of these people that takes so much beer that they have to stay close to the what we call the restroom. Now, he's played cat and mouse with me. This is one of the things that I wanted to bring to your attention a little bit later, the thing that we need your help in. But he'd tell me one story, tell somebody else another story, tell his family doctor another story, tell his wife another story. How he remembered the story that he told me the last time, and without getting them all mixed up, I'm darned if I know. But the fact that he had had a couple of alcoholic convulsions on the job wasn't enough to persuade him that he had a problem that he needed to do something about. AA wasn't for him. He wasn't going to have any of this bad business that they give around at AA. He'd been to a couple of meetings, but he was one of the people who had come and looked and turned away. There were a lot of them. Well, in order to get him to accept my judgment as a physician, that for him alcohol was a poison, and I told him repeatedly that his liver couldn't take it. The fact that he'd had the convulsions meant that it was getting to his brain. But still, he wanted his beer as he sat in front of his television set at home. The other month, about 3 months ago now, the supervision was ready to take my suggestion that what he needed was a month off without pay in order to persuade him that we meant what we were talking about and that he wasn't kidding anybody except himself, and that he needed to begin to take this sort of thing seriously. Is this sport? Sure, it's sport. But the alternative is a worse kind of force and a more destructive kind of force. 2 weeks ago, a boy of 26 came into the office. Came in with his father. Five children. He had been aware because of the public education that's been going on for years, articles in the current literature, articles in the newspaper, TV shows, radio shows, sort of thing that's been going on for 20 years in Rochester. He had realized that for the last year his drinking had been out of control, that most of the time after he started to drink he got drunk and he didn't like it, and he knew that he was out of control, knew that he needed to do something about it. And at the same time, knew himself well enough to know that if he waited until the next morning, that he postponed it for until the next time. And he called his father at 2 o'clock a few mornings previously, and said, "You got to come and get me and take me to the hospital." His father didn't want to, but he persuaded him to take him to the hospital after he got over the shakes, dried out enough so that he could be released from the hospital. He came in to see me. And I was able to describe to him the natural history of alcoholism. And he said, and I'm sure you know the pattern, I was beginning to doubt that I was an alcoholic. But your description to me of the natural history of alcoholism convinces me that I'm an alcoholic, that I need to do something about it. Now, whether he will accept AA at this point, I don't know. I haven't yet tried to persuade him. Haven't felt that it was quite time. I'll do my best to get as good an introduction to AA for him as I can. Whether it'll take or not, I don't know. But I think that this boy, who still had his job, who still had his family, who hadn't been terribly seriously hurt yet at 26. Maybe all he's going to need is just the understanding that he, like a diabetic, has to leave some things alone. And he has to leave alcohol alone. But it won't be possible for him to be a controlled social drinker. So much for that, and so I can give you maybe a little mental seventh-inning stretch. I'd like to read you a poem that a Presbyterian minister read to me once. If the horse and mule live 30 years and nothing know of wine or beer, the goat and sheep at 20 die and never taste of scotch or rye. The cow drinks water by the ton and at 18 is most done. The dog at 15 cashes in without the aid of rum or gin. The cat in milk and water croaks, and after 12 short years it croaks. The modest, sober, bone-dry hen lays eggs for nugs, then dies at 10. All animals are strictly dry. They sinless live and early die. But sinful, ginful, rum-soaked men survive for 80 years and 10. And some of us, well, mighty few, stay pickled till we're 92. Well, where are we? What I've been trying to say to you is that no one of us has the whole answer. That we've all got to work together. And if we're going to be able to work together, we've got to communicate, we've got to understand. And the only way we can communicate effectively, really effectively, is on a man-to-man basis. I've been saying for years at AA gatherings, go back and see your doctor, the doctors that worked with you, that failed with you. And say, remember me? Here's how. This is the sort of information that a doctor learns by, his people, what happens to people. And we can write articles in the literature, but it won't begin to reach us until we see really the facts. We need to have facts at this point and not opinion. And you are the facts. You are the kind of facts that medical men, scientists generally, can't ignore this experience. Opinions don't reach it. Facts do. So when you go back to your doctor, I wish you'd do two things. Not only tell him about you and about yourselves and how you got this way, but also tell him that it was a part of the game when you were drinking to see how little of the truth you could tell him. It is easier to lie sometimes than it is to tell the truth. And somehow or other, the doctor never gets the truth. And you know, there are two main tools that a doctor uses in his relationship to his patient. One of them is an honest history. And the second one is to follow instructions. The alcoholic doesn't need it. And if you can, as you talk with your doctors, tell them just this. Perhaps you will understand a little better how to work with you effectively. The doctors have an awful lot of meetings to go to, and they, in my experience, will groan when you suggest another one. But keep at it. Try to pick out the meeting that you think would reach, would give him the most information, invite him to that one first, and then keep him coming. And in this way, he will learn the facts. He will learn the facts not only about alcohol, but about the hazards of tranquilizers and sedatives. Too often in the past, from my observation and in my judgment, we in AA, and I say we advisedly because I've done this too, we have criticized physicians, the medical profession, for using sedatives, for using tranquilizers, for using any kind of medication. And we said, don't do it, rather than pointing out what happens when they do it. And as we think about tranquilizers, we need to remember this too, that there are in this country today, in the world today, thousands of people that are not in state hospitals, are not in mental institutions, because tranquilizers are available. People who, before tranquilizers came into the picture, would still be considered hopeless custodial cases in our mental institutions. This we tend to forget. But it's an important fact for us to remember. Another thing from the purely AA standpoint which seems to me to be very important is that some of us, in our concern about tranquilizers and the difficulties that we get into as we use tranquilizers or any of the mood changes, we tend to be so concerned, so frightened by this, that we criticize some of our own members who have been able to accept AA and get into AA only by the tranquilizer or antabuse room. And there are many of them. And as we speak, in some instances, condemning, criticizing the use of any medication as we try to find our way into AA, these people, many of them feel guilty. And at times we have made of them second-class citizens in AA. And this, it seems to me, it's unfortunate that you who have suffered so much from moral condemnation should be passing this on to some of your fellows who have suffered in the same way that you have done. One of the things that is said to me fairly frequently by people who have been in trouble and who have found their way out of it, after they've been in AA at all, they will say, "Doctor, I'm free." There's another step that we need to make after we become free. And we need to make it, in my judgment, in order to keep the freedom. Carl Becker, who was a historian at Cornell University several years ago, said this, and it has since been called Becker's Law. "Since I am free to do as I please, I am responsible for that which I am pleased to do." This is another one of the paradoxes in AA, the paradox in life. We don't keep AA unless we give it away. We don't keep our freedom until we take the responsibility which makes freedom meaningful. What have I been trying to say this morning? There are all kinds of people in trouble with alcohol, each in their own way. and there is no one way which will answer the problem of everybody. Second, we don't need to wait for low bottom. We can bring bottom up, providing we will use our knowledge, our intelligence, effectively. This is hard. In industry, we have tools to use which aren't available to many people outside of industry. But we can use our courts, we can use our judges to promote the acceptance of the first step in AA, that life in some department at least has become unmanageable. We must continue to take inventory as individuals, as groups, as a movement. We must not become satisfied with AA as it is because today I'm happily sober. We need to be critical. We need to be ready and willing to accept the responsibility for taking a little bit of somebody else's inventory sometimes. Be willing to have somebody else take our inventory. It's a little better if we ask for it than it is to wait until our friends get the courage up enough to do it. But if you ask for it, and because all of us have blind spots, we need to ask for it. This is the way we grow. It's only in this way that we stay young ourselves. It's only in this way that we can keep AA young, vital, flexible, attractive, growing, and open-minded. We need to accept the responsibility that goes along with our freedom. And one of the things that I hope sincerely that you will do, because it will help us all, you should go back to your doctors, show yourselves as facts, and help them to understand how our minds as alcoholics work. That we rob them of two of the major tools on which the practice of medicine depends. One is an honest history. Second is follow instructions. It's been real fun being with you. You've been very patient. Thanks very much.
I'm sure you all agree with me that our General Service Board is in good hands. We all want to thank you, Doctor, for your insight. The new look that business is given, with the thing of alcoholism.